Chapter 17. Play. Vins de main soir, Gita Tendrai at 8 o'clock, Passage des Panoramas. My Sirs at his country. Adieu et demain. Fifin. Samedi. I shuddered as I walked through this very Passage des Panoramas, in the evening. The girl was there, pacing to and fro, and looking in the countenance of every passerby, to recognize Atwood. Adieu et demain. There was a dreadful meaning in the words, which the writer of them little knew. Adieu et demain. The morrow was come, and the soul of the poor suicide was now in the presence of God. I dare not think of his fate, for, except in the fact of his poverty and desperation, was he worse than any of us, his companions, who had shared his debauches, and marched with him up to the very brink of the grave? There is but one more circumstance to relate regarding poor Jack his burial. It was of a piece with his death. He was nailed into a paltry coffin and buried, at the expense of the arrondissement, in a nook of the burial place beyond the Barrière de l'Edel. They buried him at 6 o'clock, of a bitter winter's morning, and it was with difficulty that an English clergyman could be found to read a service over his grave. The three men who have figured in this history acted as Jack's mourners. And as the ceremony was to take place so early in the morning, these men sat up the night through, and were almost drunk as they followed his coffin to its resting place. Moral. When we turned out in our great coats, said one of them afterwards, reeking of cigars and brandy and water, D.E., sir, we quite frightened the old buck of a parson. He did not much like our company. After the ceremony was concluded, these gentlemen were very happy to get home to a warm and comfortable breakfast, and finished the day royally at Frascati's. Napoleon and his system. On Prince Louis Napoleon's work. Any person who recollects the history of the absurd outbreak of Strasbourg, in which Prince Louis Napoleon Bonaparte figured, 3 years ago, must remember that, however silly the revolt was, however foolish its pretext, however doubtful its aim, and inexperienced its leader, there was, nevertheless, a party, and a considerable one in France, that were not unwilling to lend the new projectors their aid. The troops who declared against the prince were, it was said, all but willing to declare for him, and it was certain that, in many of the regiments of the army, there existed a strong spirit of disaffection, and an eager wish for the return of the imperial system and family. As to the good that was to be derived from the change, that is another question. Why the Emperor of the French should be better than the King of the French, or the King of the French better than the King of France and Navarre, it is not our business to inquire. But all the three monarchs have no lack of supporters. Republicanism has no lack of supporters. Saint-Simonianism was followed by a respectable body of admirers. Robespierreism has a select party of friends. If, in a country where so many quacks have had their day, Prince Louis Napoleon thought he might renew the imperial quackery, why should he not? It has recollections with it that must always be dear to a gallant nation. It has certain claptraps in its vocabulary that can never fail to inflame a vain, restless, grasping, disappointed one. In the first place, and don't let us endeavor to disguise it, they hate us. Not all the protestations of friendship, not all the wisdom of Lord Palmerston, not all the diplomacy of our distinguished plenipotentiary, Mr. Henry Lytton Bulwer, and let us add, not all the benefit which both countries would derive from the alliance can make it, in our times at least, permanent and cordial. They hate us. The Carlist organs revile us with a querulous fury that never sleeps. The moderate party, if they admit the utility of our alliance, are continually pointing out our treachery, our insolence, and our monstrous infractions of it. And for the Republicans, as sure as the morning comes, the columns of their journals thunder out volleys of fierce denunciations against our unfortunate country. They live by feeding the natural hatred against England, by keeping old wounds open, by recurring ceaselessly to the history of old quarrels, and as in these we, by God's help, by land and by sea, in old times and late, have at the uppermost. They perpetuate the shame and mortification of the losing party, the bitterness of past defeats, and the eager desire to avenge them. A party which knows how to exploit this hatred will always be popular to a certain extent, and the imperial scheme has this, at least, among its conditions. Then there is the favorite claptrap of the natural frontier. The Frenchman yearns to be bounded by the Rhine and the Alps, and next follows the cry, let France take her place among nations, and direct, as she ought to do, the affairs of Europe. These are the two chief articles contained in the new imperial program, if we may credit the journal which has been established to advocate the cause. A natural boundary stand among the nation's popular development Russian alliance, and a reduction of La Perfide Albion to its proper insignificance. As yet we know little more of the plan. And yet such foundations are sufficient to build a party upon, and with such windy weapons a substantial government is to be overthrown. In order to give these doctrines, such as they are, a chance of finding favor with his countrymen, Prince Louis has the advantage of being able to refer to a former great professor of them, his uncle Napoleon. His attempt is at once pious and prudent. It exalts the memory of the uncle, and furthers the interests of the nephew, who attempts to show what Napoleon's ideas really were, what good had already resulted from the practice of them, how cruelly they had been thwarted by foreign wars and difficulties, and what vast benefits would have resulted from them. And it is reasonable to conclude, might still, if the French nation would be wise enough, to pitch upon a governor that would continue the interrupted scheme. It is, however, to be borne in mind that the Emperor Napoleon had certain arguments in favor of his opinions for the time being, which his nephew has not employed. On the 13th Vendémiaire, when General Bonaparte believed in the excellence of a directory, it may be remembered that he aided his opinions by 40 pieces of artillery, and by Colonel Murat at the head of his dragoons. There was no resisting such a philosopher. The directory was established forthwith, and the sacred cause of the minority triumphed. In like manner, when the general was convinced of the weakness of the directory, and saw fully the necessity of establishing a consulate, what were his arguments? Moreau, Lannes, Murat, Berthier, Leclerc, Lefebvre, gentle apostles of the truth, marched to St. Cloud, and there, with fixed bayonets, caused it to prevail. Error vanished in an instant. At once 500 of its high priests tumbled out of windows, and lo! Three consuls appeared to guide the destinies of France. How much more expeditious, reasonable, and clinching was this argument of the 18th Brumaire than any one that can be found in any pamphlet. A fig for your duodecimos and octavos. Talk about points, there are none like those at the end of a bayonet, and the most powerful of styles is a good rattling article from a 9-pounder. At least this is our interpretation of the manner in which were always propagated the ideas Napoleonians. Not such, however, is Prince Louis' belief. And, if you wish to go along with him in opinion, you will discover that a more liberal, peaceable, prudent prince never existed. You will read that the mission of Napoleon was to be the estamentary executor of the revolution, and the prince should have added the legatee, or, more justly still, as well as the executor, he should be called the executioner, and then his title would be complete. In Vendémiaire, the military Tartuffe, he threw aside the revolution's natural heirs, and made her, as it were, alter her will. On the 18th of Brumaire he strangled her, and on the 19th seized on her property, and kept it until force deprived him of it. Illustrations, to be sure, are no arguments, but the example is the prince's, not ours. In the prince's eyes, then, his uncle is a god. Of all monarchs, the most wise, upright, and merciful. 30 years ago the opinion had millions of supporters, while millions again were ready to avouch the exact contrary. It is curious to think of the former difference of opinion concerning Napoleon, and, In reading his nephew's rapturous encomiums of him, one goes back to the days when we ourselves were as loud and mad in his dispraise. Who does not remember his own personal hatred and horror, 25 years ago, for the man whom we used to call the Ludi Corsican upstart and assassin? What stories did we not believe of him? What murders, rapes, robberies, not laid to his charge, we who were living within a few miles of his territory, and might, by books and newspapers, be made as well acquainted with his merits or demerits as any of his own countrymen. Then was the age, when the ideas Napoleonians might have passed through many editions. For while we were thus outrageously bitter, our neighbors were as extravagantly attached to him by a strange infatuation, adored him like a god, whom we chose to consider as a fiend, and vowed that, under his government, their nation had attained its highest pitch of grandeur and glory. In revenge there existed in England, as is proved by 1,000 authentic documents, a monster so hideous, a tyrant so ruthless and bloody, that the world's history cannot show his parallel. This ruffian's name was, during the early part of the French Revolution, Petit Cobourg. Petit Cobourg's emissaries were in every corner of France. Petit Cobourg's gold chinked in the pockets of every traitor in Europe. It menaced the life of the godlike Robespierre. It drove into cellars and fits of delirium even the gentle philanthropist Merit. It 14 times caused the dagger to be lifted against the bosom of the first consul, emperor, and king, that first, great, glorious, irresistible, cowardly, contemptible, bloody hero and fiend, Bonaparte, before mentioned. On our side of the channel we have had leisure, long since, to reconsider our verdict against Napoleon, though, to be sure, we have not changed our opinion about Petit Cobourg. After 35 years all parties bear witness to his honesty, and speak with affectionate reverence of his patriotism, his genius, and his private virtue. In France, however, or, at least among certain parties in France, there has been no such modification of opinion. With the Republicans, Petit Cobourg is Petit Cobourg still, crafty, bloody, seeking whom he may devour, and perfide Albion more perfidious than ever. This hatred is the point of union between the Republic and the Empire. It has been fostered ever since, and must be continued by Prince Louis, if he would hope to conciliate both parties. With regard to the Emperor, then, Prince Louis erects to his memory as fine a monument as his wits can raise. One need not say that the imperial apologist's opinion should be received with the utmost caution, for a man who has such a hero for an uncle may naturally be proud of and partial to him. And when this nephew of the great man would be his heir likewise, and, hearing his name, step also into his imperial shoes, one may reasonably look for much affectionate panegyric. "The empire was the best of empires," cries the prince, and possibly it was. Undoubtedly, the prince thinks it was, but he is the very last person who would convince a man with the proper suspicious impartiality. One remembers a certain consultation of politicians which is recorded in the spelling book, and the opinion of that patriotic sage who avowed that, for a real blameless constitution, an impenetrable shield for liberty, and cheap defense of nations, there was nothing like leather. Let us examine some of the prince's article. If we may be allowed humbly to express an opinion, his letter is not only quite insufficient for those vast public purposes for which he destines it, but is, moreover, and in itself, very bad letter. The hides are poor small unsound slips of skin, or, to drop this cobbling metaphor, the style is not particularly brilliant, the facts not very startling, and, as for the conclusions, one may differ with almost every one of them. Here is an extract from his first Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.